originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you this evening from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. Thank you, everyone, listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206. Also, to those of you tuning in to our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF is a wonderful organization that provides financial assistance to riders who have given everything to the sport. If you're able to help, please visit the website at www.pdjf.org. So this is just no ordinary show. This will be the 100th episode of Jock Talk, and we are in for a very special hour. We are just a few days away from the Belmont Stakes. Well, my guest won the Belmont by 31 lengths to a Triple Crown victory 43 years ago aboard Secretariat, considered by many to be the greatest racehorse of all time, with 3,032 wins and over $28 million in earnings. He really needs no introduction, jockey Ron Turcotte. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
So great to have you here, Ron. And you must have a busy week ahead of you. Will you be attending the Belmont?
Yes. I'm leaving tomorrow, so I'll spend a few days there. And watch a race, and return on Sunday, I guess.
How is it for you, Ron, going back to that track for that race?
Yeah, we'll make that 44 years ago.
44 years ago. 44
yeah,
years
45
ago.
45 next year,
yeah. And how is it for you going back and watching the Belmont, and it has to be...
It's always a pleasure. I mean, I enjoy going to the Belmont. Matter of fact, I enjoyed going to the Derby, Preakness, and Belmont. But Belmont was special because that's where I made my headquarters.
It has to bring back a lot of memories for you, Ron. A lot of memories.
Yeah, sure does.
And how far of a drive is that? You're currently living in Canada, correct?
That's correct. I'm just right across the border from Maine, the state of Maine. So,
is that a long drive for you?
To Belmont?
Yes.
No, I cut it in half. I go to Sturbridge, Massachusetts, and then I finish the next day.
Perfect.
So it's not a bad ride. It's only a 12-hour for me. Anyway, I could do it one day, but I don't push it.
Don't blame you there, Ron. And you're originally from Canada, and tell us where you grew up, Ron.
I grew up not far from where I live now, about 3 miles. So I had purchased some land here for speculation, and after I got hurt, I had to remodel my house completely. And it was like building and the exterior elevator and all that, so I could carry the 3 floors. And we decided to come home. Mom and Dad was still living, and my wife's mother was still living. So We moved here, and we kind of, I built mom and dad an apartment in my house, and our house, actually, my wife and I. And so they stayed with us the last 10 years of their life, which was beautiful.
That's wonderful. You've taken such great care of your parents, Ron, and you're one of, you had a large family. You're one of how many children?
Well, my mother had 14 children, and she lost one only about a week after birth. And I had a brother that died. He was a 1.5 year old. And that was a bad flu going around, bad virus or flu, really. I don't remember what they called that flu, but he died in that. So there's 12 of us. Grew to maturity. You know, I mean, there was family of 12.
Large family, Ron, my goodness, one of 12 children. Did any of your siblings go onto the racetrack as well?
Yes, I had 4 brothers that followed me. There was 5 of us. I think we are one of the biggest family brothers at the most brother that rode. There's myself, Noel, Rudy, Roger, and Eve. We all done pretty good.
Well, I'm sure they looked up to you, Ron, during your career, and you went kind of a strange path. You originated, you started out as a lumberjack. That's what I hear, anyway. Is that true?
Yes, that's right. I left school at 14 and went to the lumber with my dad. And I used to care for the horses and, you know, harness them, feed them, you name it. Everything that has to do around horses and shoe them, the whole thing. So that was, my dad was a very good horseman in his own right. And with different horses and thoroughbred, but he gave me a good beginning there. You know, I learned a lot from him.
And those were the horses that you used to help you carry the lumber, is that?
Yes, we used to, they call that snake through the trees there, snake to a yard where it was cut up and log size or pulpwood. And then in the winter I used to drive a team and hauling lumber from the main road, from the wood to the main road or to a river where they were going to be driven in the spring. They call it a spring drive on a river, and I done that too.
You were very young. That had to be hard work for such a young man.
Well, that's one of the reasons, I guess, I left to go to Toronto to look for work in the construction business, house building and that, and house roofing. And being that the carpenters are on strike, there was no work to be had, so I kept looking for work until my landlord suggested I try the racetrack. And I didn't know anything about the racetrack and horse racing 6 days a week. The only horse race I had seen before was the cowboys racing down Main Street. So I didn't know anything about racing at the time. And after being there a month, couldn't find no work. And then the third day after that man suggested I try the racetrack, I managed to get in. I needed a pass to get in. I couldn't. I could turn down the gate 2 days. And then the third day, I was hitchhiking, and a trainer picked me up. And and that's how I got into the racetrack. And got lucky. I got a job right away with Winfield Farm. That's where I learned to... there wasn't much of learning rubbing horses. I was used to that, so I only walk horses for a day or two, and then he gave me some horses to rub. So I rubbed horses for 4 months, and then Pete McCain, the trainer, he was the guy that had won more Queen's Plate at the time than anybody. And they sent me to the farm to learn to gallop horses and then break horses that fall. And then came February when they called five of us, into the office, Joe Thomas' office, and they wanted to sign us up for, to be jockeys. You worked for them for 5 years. That was a 5-year contract back then. And that's what you needed. You needed a contract to ride back in them days. But being that I was the heaviest of the five, I didn't know whether I would have that much chance of getting to be a jockey. So I asked for a little time to think about it. And I talked to George Thompson, the guy, one of the exercise boys, an ex-jockey at Whitfield Farm, and he taught me how to gallop horses and all that, and I'd like to hear what he had to say. And he told me that they always rode the leading rider, which at the time was Avelino Gomez. Mm-hmm. And so I decided against it and went to work for Gordon Huntley, who trained for the Addison Hall Stable. And that's who started me riding. It was June 21st, 1961, I rode my first race and rode another 9 races on horses that didn't have no chances, just for experience. But the following spring, April 1962, I rode my first winner and ended up the year as leading rider Canada, leading apprentice and leading rider. I followed the next year. By then, I was riding for Mr. Taylor, Woodfield Farm, and I got to ride North and Nasser. To back up a little bit, the first year that I rode, I even rode Horse of the Year, Crafty Lace, Canadian Horse of the Year. And then the following year, I rode Northern Dancer. I was a regular rider for Northern Dancer for Mr. Taylor.
Wow. So you initially turned down the offer to have a contract with Winfield Farm, and then you wait a little bit longer, then before you know it, you're riding for them, you're riding Northern Dancer, you're leading apprentice and leading rider, which is quite an accomplishment. You don't see that very often, an apprentice to take off so fast and to beat everyone else to become leading rider. That is quite the accomplishment. And Ron, what was that like? Do you remember that first winner?
Oh, yes. Horse called Pheasant Lane. It was muddy. And he was a real fast horse, but this one day stumbled leaving the gate, and so I was sitting back with him, and then I just turned for home, and I won that race. That was really something else, winning my first race. The following day, I won two, and within a week, I was leading rider, and I guess I was too aggressive, and I got suspension, and then came back with leading rider again to pick it up where I left off. Not really where I left off, but I ended up leading rider again. They get another 10 days, and at that time they were suspending you for 10 days. But anyway, I learned to be a little more careful, and ended up here, like I said, ended up the year of leading rider. And midsummer, I got a call from Mr. Taylor and through Joe Thomas that he wanted me to ride their first call on all Canadian breds for them. And that's how I come out, wind up riding Northern Dancer.
Northern Dancer. And you were still an apprentice at this time?
Pardon?
You were still an apprentice when you had the opportunity to ride Northern Dancer?
Yes.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Northern Dancer, of course, such an accomplished racehorse, horse of the year.
When, after I lost my apprenticeship, I continued on. I was way in front. I was 100 winners in front of the second leading rider. And somebody asked me to go ride in Maryland. I decided to, I asked Mr. Huntley, and he says, well, you've done everything that, you accomplished everything that you set out to become here. He says, go ahead, go prove yourself. So I went to Bowie, meeting. I had already started that, a fall meeting. But then the Laurel meeting, I was leading rider and Pimlico. So I ended up the year leading in Maryland also. And I returned the following year. I was leading rider at Bowie, the winter meeting, Laurel, and Pimlico, and Delaware before I moved on to New York. That's where I was heading. And so I settled in real good in New York. I was at Saratoga. I was I only went about 10 races, but then when we returned to Aqueduct, Belmont was being run at Aqueduct, but I ended up leading rider that meeting, Belmont meeting at Aqueduct, and then the Aqueduct meeting. So I finished the year real good, and that set me up for a place to stay.
I would say so, Ron. Have you ever, I'm sure you have, you stopped to count how many leading rider titles you've won throughout your career?
How many what?
How many leading rider titles at the different racetracks?
Oh, my God. I led many meetings in New York throughout my career in New York. I was a leading rider at different racetrack more than once, and leading rider at Saratoga at the time. And so I would say just about any track I've rode at constantly. I rode all the meeting, with the exception of High Leo. Mm-hmm. I think it's I had one of the title.
Too many to count, right, Ron? Too many to count. And you settled into New York, and tell us about your first graded stakes victory.
My what?
Your first graded stakes victory.
Oh, my God. I had so many I can't remember now. I can't remember. Race I rode in New York, the stake race I won. Then I got to ride Shuvi, the great mayor of our time. Got to ride Fort Marcy, Damascus. Van Denor won the only horse to win the Isle of Turf Series. That's three races that the same horse won in them all. And I won a lot of races more than once. The Suburban, the Brooklyn, at Saratoga, I won the, at that time, the Coaching Club American was in New York. I was riding Keith in and summer guest for Mr. Mellon, and she was a top mare. I won a Black Eyed Susan with her Coaching Club American Oath, the Mamet Oath, besides all the other stake races I won on her.
You've just...
I can't really remember right now, right off the hand like that. Top of my head, all the top horses I rode. I know that 16 of them are in the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
16 horses that I sat on. Not necessarily the steady rider, but I'm sitting in my office now, and I'm looking. I can see a dozen picture with Shuvi on. And Shuby became the richest mayor of all time in 1970, I believe.
She's one of my favorites, Ron. She's such a talented mayor, and my goodness, everything she accomplished. Washington, D.C. International, United Nations, Jockey Club, Gold Cup, Diana. I mean, just so many victories, my gosh.
Yeah, the Diana, I won more than once. I can't remember them all there.
Yeah, she was just so talented. I'm sorry, she didn't win the Washington, D.C. International. That was Fort Marcy. Another.
I wasn't on in that day.
Okay, but you
I
still.
I believe Velasquez probably rode in that day.
What?
I rode a filly called Fanfreluche, which had won the Quebec Derby, the Manitoba Centennial Derby, and the big race for fillies in. At Saratoga and then in New York also. She was the top mayor.
Shuby.
That's the mayor that was kidnapped back years ago from Claiborne Farm.
Oh, that's
right. She was carrying a fall by Secretariat.
Secretariat. Well, it's about time we started talking about him, Ron. And I mentioned this time of year has to bring back so many memories for you. Secretariat, as I mentioned in the introduction, considered by many to be the greatest racehorse of all time. Tell us how you first became involved with him.
Well, I was riding for Meadow Stable at the time. I had ridden River Ridge, a two-year-old championship. When I got on him there, we went. He had ran four times before I got on him. When I got on him, then he won the rest of the year undefeated. He was champion, two-year-old. He was second most, had won most races as a two-year-old at $550,000. Then that was a lot of money. And he's the reason that Meadow Stable got to keep the farm, because he came back, and next year we won the Kentucky Derby. The Preakness was in the mud, but a Bluegrass Kentucky Derby, and then in the Preakness, the mud, he didn't like mud, so we got beaten that one. When we came back, won the Belmont for 7 months. He was a top horse. He's as good as they come. And then the secretary came along, and I was riding him. So I was really riding three champions there with a filly called Talking Picture. She was also a Nicholas Award winner. And that's how I wind up riding Secretariat. I started getting on him at Hialeah when he first came to the racetrack, and he was just something unbelievable. This horse, if he was spotted like most horses I spotted today, he'd have been undefeated. But they had to syndicate the horse, so they ran him whenever a big race came around. And, he was winning breaking track records, world records. He was just unbelievable.
That he was, Ron. And you mentioned Riva Ridge, who I suppose people kind of forget about him a little bit just because he was maybe overshadowed a bit by Secretariat's success, but he accomplished so much. You mentioned the Kentucky Derby victory and the Belmont victory in 1972, and he was an incredible racehorse of his own right. And
oh, yes, he was also the four-year-old. He broke five track records, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think if the track had not turned out sloppy on Preakness Day, he would have been a Triple Crown winner as well?
Yeah, back-to-back, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, he was the best best three-year-old of its time of his year.
What was that like winning the Derby aboard him?
I was so confident in him. He had won the... The only thing I worried about him was the mud. He won the Bluegrass very easy, and I didn't think that he could get beat in the Derby. But when the mud came in and at Pimlico there, that was a different story. But we had another horse called Upper Case that we won the Florida Derby and Wood Memorial with him, and he was a good mud horse. He was also injured in the Preakness, but they scratched him before the rain started.
Upper Keys, another very, very successful racehorse you've been aboard, Ron, and he liked the mud, so a shame they scratched him then in the Preakness, since the track turned up sloppy, but Riva Ridge didn't handle that type of racetrack. But then he came right back at the Belmont, and of course,
he won that one very easy, won by 7 lengths, and then we crossed the mountain, went to California, Hollywood Park, and he won Hollywood Derby.
Well, Ron, let's talk more here in a bit. We'll continue our visit with jockey Ron Turcott after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. Gerard Melanson had a great week at Evangeline as he won the Lafayette Stakes aboard Tiger Storm and the Evangeline Mile aboard Iron Fist. Melanson finished in the money on 56% of his mounts with 2 wins, 2 seconds, and 1 third place finish. Javier Castellano enjoyed success on his trip to Penn Nationals. He won 3 of his 6 stakes mounts on the card. Castellano finished in the money on 64% of his mounts with 4 wins, 7 seconds, and 3 third place finishes. Irad Ortiz Jr. also made the most out of his trip to Penn National as he won the Grade 2 Penn Mile aboard Frostmourne. Ortiz led North America in earnings and finished in the money on 67% of his mounts from 5 wins, 5 seconds, and 4 third place finishes. Finally, the Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Corey Lannery, had an impressive week highlighted by a win in the Grade 3 Aristides aboard Limousine Liberal. On Saturday, Lannery had a mount in each of the 11 races and ended the day with 5 wins, 2 seconds, and 2 third place finishes. Lannery finished the week tied for most wins in North America with 9 and added 3 seconds and 7 third place finishes. John Parada's newest book, Half a Chance, is available now on JockeyTalk360.com and for Kindle at Amazon.com. Half a Chance is the story of a down-on-his-luck jockey agent who finds himself entangled in a web of deceit and larceny and provides the kind of entertaining read that is ideal for any racing fan. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at JockeyTalk.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I'm joined tonight by jockey Ron Turcotte. Ron, before the break, we were just getting started with Secretariat's story and how you first started riding him. And we mentioned Riva Ridge, a highly successful racehorse himself. You mentioned Upper Keys, another one. And Secretariat, you started riding at Hialeah, you mentioned earlier. And Hialeah, I want to talk about Hialeah just a minute. I've never been there myself, but Chris McCarron says that's the most beautiful racetrack he's ever been at. Is that, do you share the same feeling?
I think he's got that right. It was a beautiful, back in the, them days there, the track was so beautiful. We had all kind of exotic animals there. We had flies, the flamingo in between. It was a great place to race in the winter.
And you were working Secretariat here when he was preparing to run for the first time?
Well, are you talking about the three-year-old or the two-year-old?
As a two-year-old.
As a two-year-old, yes. We that's where he started. You know, I started galloping him and working him there. And then we came to New York, and I was in Hollywood the first time he ran out to ride the... I wasn't in Hollywood. I went to ride Riva Ridge in the Hollywood Derby. After I won the race, Lucien wanted me to ride Secretariat the following Saturday. That's right, the following Saturday. And I was already committed to ride Summer Guest in a Mammoth Oaks. So I asked him if he could, find another race for him. He said, well, we want to run him there. So I couldn't ride him the first time I rode Summer Guest and won the Mammoth Oaks. And the second time I couldn't ride him again because I had a horse called Overproof that died of a heart attack around the 2316 in the eighth fold. Mm. And I had contusion of the back, lung, and heart muscle, and the doctor stopped me from riding for 10-12 days, I believe. So I didn't get to ride him until we get to Saratoga. And I rode him from then. We didn't get beat, even though he did get disqualified in the Champagne. There was a horse called Linda Chief at Tennessee to run out, and he ran into Stop the Music, who in turn touched my horse at the back, and my horse at the back turned him in, but they disqualified him anyway. Mm. But he went on the rest of the year undefeated. Then our plan was to was mapped out to start running the Florida route with the Flamingo and Florida Derby, and then go on to Kentucky and the Bluegrass, so on. But Mr. Chenry passed away, and the horse had to be syndicated to Pretty State, Texas. And so we had to change our plan completely. Then we went the New York route. He won his first two starts in New York, the Bayshore and the Gotham, then the Wynn Memorial. He came down with a big abscess under his upper lip and blood infection, which I didn't know at the time. The boys knew, but for some reason or other, he didn't let me know, and I knew he didn't get his final work for the race, but he ran anyway and he finished 30. Angel Light won the race, and Train finished second, and I was third. Had I known, all he had to do was turn his head loose. He was a heavy-headed horse, and whenever I pick his head up is when he's done his best running.
Right.
So that's the way what I was trying to do with him. And anyway, we got beat there, but then we came back to Kentucky. We moved the ship to Kentucky. And the first work I didn't like because you still didn't want to take hold of the bit. And but the last final workout before the Derby, you worked beautiful. And I was afraid that maybe we had lost a little training with him, mm-hmm. with that infection and the abscess. So I took him back to last in the Kentucky Derby, the first part. And after Pat the Wire the first time around, I started working my way up, and by the head of the stretch I was catching, there was no shame in front of me. And I caught him by the eight pole and went on and galloped by two and a half length and set a new track record for the Derby. Stake record, track record.
Does that record still stand, Ron?
Pardon?
Does that record still stand?
Could you repeat that, please?
Does that track record still stand?
Still stand, yes.
That's what I thought. And that was the largest crowd was there attending the Derby that was seen at the time. It was just a massive turnout. And that had to be an absolutely incredible feeling, especially after the previous defeat in the Wood Memorial. You knew something wasn't right. And then in the Derby, he was back.
It was kind of vindication in a sense, you know. And so all I had to do was use a little judgment, you know, and make sure I had, you know, I didn't use him really for nothing.
Right.
But then he was 100% for the Preakness, and we went to Pimlico, to Baltimore, and I worked him on the Sunday before the race. And you went 3/4 of a mile in 110, I believe. We were actually only working 5/8 of a mile, and that's where they measured his stride. Then anyway, we went on and won the Preakness very easily. I passed every horse around the first turn. I was more sure of his fitness and what he could do. So I made that bold move around the first turn. Everybody was calling me nuts, but I thought I knew what I was doing, and it turned out right. And we set a new another track record. By the track not functioning, the track teletimer not functioning right there. They didn't give us a record right away. It took like 40 years, 39 years to be exact, before they gave us a track record.
Right. I just heard that Penny Chenery went up to Maryland and they finally got that in place, as you mentioned, after so many years of waiting, and that was finally put in place, and he was back. You were so confident riding him that day. You made that early move, and what was that feeling like, Ron, to be aboard such a tremendous animal? His stride and the way he moved, that had to be just an incredible feeling.
It was. And we worked him pretty hard for the Belmont. I was working him 2 full seconds faster than I had worked River Ridge for the same race for the Belmont. And there again, they called me nuts what I was doing, letting him run. I wasn't really asking him to run, but I was letting him run. Go ahead and head with Shane for a ways, and then pulling away from him and winning by 31 lengths. Mm. I was kind of peeved that they didn't give us a record, and I figured, well, I'll let them run today. And Rainey did.
31 lengths. It was...
And it took two and three-fifths of the track record.
Wow. And that record still stands.
Yes, all his records.
All of his records still stand. Yeah. They can't be
all
matched.
All classic records.
Right, right. Quite cool. An incredible racehorse. An incredible racehorse. And then he wins the Belmont by 31 lengths. And he comes back in, what was it, 3 weeks?
He came back. Well, our plan was to wait and run him in all the races were mapped out, but everything changed as we went along. They ran him in the Chicago Invitational. That was a new race. So we ran Chicago. He won by 9 lengths, I think, Mm-hmm. And I didn't break track record. I was 1/5 of track record, but I didn't really let him run. And then they mentioned the Travers, but then the last minute they decided to run him in the Whitney. But he had been sick. He was running a fever for a full week before. Mm-hmm. And so they insisted on running him there. I begged them not to run him. But anyway, they ran him. I don't know who insisted on running him. But anyway, then that kind of ruined him. We couldn't run him in the Travers. I picked up a mount on Annihilatum. I won the Travers, but Secretary was recuperating, and then I had to train him real hard for the Marlboro Cup that they had the deal with Marlboro people that they were going to match. First, it started as a match race. Riva Ridge and Secretary, they were the two best horses running at the time. So they invited horses from California, from all over the country, and even overseas. It was an open race by invitation, I should say. And we set a new world record in that race, too, 1:45.2 for mile and eight.
Riva Ridge was second in that race, correct?
And Riva Ridge was second, and he also broke the track record.
And
then we went on. From there, we were going to run him in the Man of War. And in between that, we had slowed down. See, that was a mile 1/8. And we had kind of eased up on him a little bit, and we were going to crank him up to run him in the Man of War. Mm-hmm. Well, all of a sudden, a couple of days before the race, they decided to run him in the Woodward. When they ran him in the Whitney, Onion beat him, but he didn't belong on the same racetrack. Matter of fact, I think it beat him something like 15-20 lengths in the Marlboro Cup.
Wow.
But when he decided to run Secretariat in the Woodward, I told him, I said, man, Mr. Horn, I said, he's not ready to run a mile and a half. And I said, he didn't get his prep work either, his final prep. And so he stopped by the jock show that afternoon when he came to the racetrack, and he told me that he wasn't running him, that they had put him in there just to scare horses for Riva Ridge. So they crashed Riva Ridge, and they ran him in the race, and he came in second, but at the quarter pole, he was a dead horse. And then 2 weeks after that, we ran him, and we really trained him. It served as a good work for the Man of War, but that's about what it did. I mean, he shouldn't have run in the race, and if he was ready, Prove-Out would never have beaten him.
Prove-Out won that day, that's right.
And then he came on the grass. He was trained so good on the grass, I told Lucian. I said, this sucker is so good on drag, you just wouldn't believe it. I said, this this horse is beyond imagination. So anyway, we ran in the Man of War. I put him in the lead and just galloped the race. I was playing cat and mouse with Tentam, who was the champion up to that time, grass horse, and beat him like five, six lengths, I think, and never had to let him run. And then again, set a track record.
Dirt, turf, ran on anything.
Go ahead. Go ahead, you were going to ask something?
I said he ran on the dirt, he ran on the turf, he would run on anything.
Oh, you're running on slop. Yeah. Slop, muddy, it didn't matter. I think he'd run on broken bottles.
Yeah.
But anyway, his last final race, I didn't get to ride him again, but I get to prepare him for the race. So I went and worked him at Woodbine, and the real time work was 56 and change. They get 57, I think, but you're in 56. 5 bits of a mile going across a main dirt track. And Maple rode him, and he won by 6 lengths. And the track was knee-deep, so he didn't set no track record in that one, but he won all by himself.
And that was up at Woodbine in the Canadian International. And
that's correct.
Yeah, you mentioned Eddie Maple rode him.
That's right.
What, were you injured, or what was the reason behind that?
No, I was suspended.
Oh, suspended. You had days.
I got suspended. I was on a two-year-old. That was the first race, first two-year-old race on the turf that was ever run in the United States. And my filly, we were running on the inner turf course, and the lights, when the light blinked, a young horse like that, first time he run, he seen that, he run next to it. My horse ducked out, and he did bother Yucazo, Baeza. But I don't think I should have got these. And Stewart told me that if I was thinking of appealing, that they would hold the appeal on the day of the race, the Woodbine race.
Really?
You see, I was a representative of the guild.
Right.
And I guess they got a dislike for me because I would stand up for the riders. Mm-hmm. If the rider was wrong, if it was his fault, he bothered somebody, something like that, I would tell them, hey, don't ask me to go there, I'll bury you. And if the writer was right, I would go in and I would fight for it. I would tell the stewards what I thought. And I think they had it in for me. And they, I just suspended and couldn't ride them. I was very disappointed. Probably the biggest blow in my career. I mean, it was like coming home with a champion, showing them off in front of my own people, and as well as where I started. And it was a terrible feeling anyway.
I can't imagine. But you rode him to all of his success and unfortunately weren't able to ride him that day. And that, I can't imagine, that would be so disappointing. I know, Ron, any time I was unable to ride a mount I'd been riding regularly, I couldn't watch the race. I didn't want to watch the race because I felt like I should be on there. I can't imagine not being able to ride Secretariat at Woodbine, your home track, had to be disappointing, but my goodness. And that was his last race.
Yes.
And was that because of the syndication? They had made that agreement that he would only run for a certain period of time?
That's correct. He was to enter the stud duty, well, not right away, like the following spring, but he was to be at the farm, a Claiborne farm, by November. There was some agreement with Mr. Taylor, who owned some shares in him, and Mr. Jean Louis Levesque. They were Canadians, and they decided, we had a discussion, Lucien Lauren and I, I wanted them to run him in the Arc de Triomphe to show the world what he could do.
Yeah.
But I guess I didn't. As jockey, don't have much to say where the horse goes anyway. they don't have much to say when the horse runs, what he does. But when you get on them every day, you know exactly what they feel like, how fit they are, and I mean, a jockey can tell the trainer a lot about horses and his condition.
Absolutely, and anytime you mentioned holding out when he wasn't ready and proved that you were right, but like you said, and unfortunately, I don't always listen to the jock. But how was it working for Lucian? Was he good to work for?
Well, we get along very good, Lucian and I. I had ridden for him before, but he had some owners, like in Florida. For 3 years, I rode for him, and we really done good together. But then you pick up an outfit, when we returned to New York, you'd pick up an outfit, and they wanted the owners, like Claiborne Farm was one of them one time, other time was somebody else that you pick up. And after I'd been preparing the horses and that, and then they'd say, well, you want so-and-so on this horse, and I'd say, well, it's all right, then I better go my way, you go your way, and that's the way we did it for them years, and until River Ridge came along, and then I stayed with them for 3 years, and then I felt that my horsemanship, or didn't count as much, so I figured, well, time to move on, and that's how I went up. I got to ride for Green Tree Stable. I was riding for Sydney Waters. I was riding for so many top trainers, Sylvie's, the whole Sylvie's barn. So that's John Veach's father.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and because I rode for him when I first came to New York, and rode a horse called Cornish Prince, the first one I rode for him. But throughout my time in New York, I would ride for him. I rode Damascus. I rode so many great horses that are short in my short career.
The list is long, Ron. I ran out of ink printing out a list of all of your great, great victories. And how about Penny? How about Penny Chenery? Do you still keep in touch with her?
Oh, yes. I see her every time she comes down, comes to New York or the Circuit Air Festival in Kentucky. We always get together.
She seems like a wonderful person. I've never met her, but she seems like such a great person for the sport.
Yeah, we never had words there. I know in the movies, and I've seen it, she was trolling us and stuff like that. That never took place. And we only had one word one time after he got beaten. The word they wanted to put somebody else on him for the Man of War. And so I asked her, told her I thought she owed me the courtesy of looking at the film with me and telling me what I did wrong. And after we look at the film, she says, well, you're on him. She couldn't find anything I'd done wrong. So she could see. I told her the horse was short. I told her.
You were right.
She was a wonderful lady. I got along good.
Ron, I can't believe how fast time's flying right now. We just have a couple minutes left. I want to mention, as I said during the introduction, we support the PDJF here on Jock Talk. Such a wonderful organization. In 1978, you had a horrific accident at Belmont Park, of all places. And It's left you paralyzed from the waist down, and you attend lots of PDJF events, and you are such a great ambassador for the sport and for PDJF. And tell us a little bit about what the PDJF does for people like yourself.
Well, PDJF stands for Permanently Disabled Jockeys. And, well, whenever I can go go someplace, I'm invited to go, let's say, for like Oklahoma or Delaware Park or different racetracks. Sometimes they invite me to go there, and I go and sign, and the profit goes to the PDJF. But I'm not the biggest donor. There's a lot of people that help. It's a group of people that get together, and we all try to do something for PDJF.
And Ron, it has to be so hard for you? You had to stop doing what you loved because of such a horrific injury, and that has to be difficult.
It was difficult in the sense that I love riding so much, but it didn't stop my life. You know, I came home. I had farms here, and I raised cattle. Every one of my kids had their own horse. And they bred some horses here. But I also had bred some race horses during my career as a rider. Until 1970, a jockey could deduct, or anybody in a racetrack could deduct the expenses of breeding horses. Anything had to do with the business.
Yeah.
And then they stopped that. So I got to breed six horses, I think, six, seven horses. And then naturally you got to sell them because you're not allowed to run horses.
Right.
Being a jockey. And they all made out good.
Well, Ron, you have so much going for you. You're such a busy man. Wishing you all the best. I can't believe time's already up here. Wishing you all the best, and I hope you have a wonderful Belmont week. Thank you so much for joining us.
Wow, thank you. My pleasure.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website, horseracingradio.net. Don't forget, while you're there, check out all of the other great shows on the Horse Racing Radio Network, Equine Forum, Express Bet Radio. And then join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.